that ant that stood up to me.
Yeah, but we can forget about him.
Yeah, it was just one ant.
Ooh,
one ant.
Yeah, you're right. It's just one ant.
Yeah, boss, they're puny.
Hmm, puny? Say, let's pretend this brain is a puny little ant.
Did that hurt?
Nope.
Well, how about this one?
Are you kidding?
Well, how about this?
You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up.
Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life.
It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line. That's why we're going back.
Does anybody else want to stay?
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Blast off!
I got a laptop. I make music with my friends. I've got a laptop, baby. I make music with my friends. There it is.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Listening to Mad Science, www.shazizradio.com. If you're having any trouble out there with the doggone player, that's because of Google shenanigans. Sorry about that. Apologize for it. Sometimes you got to go in and you got to reset the settings to allow flash. I don't know why they got to keep doing what they're doing, but it drives me nuts because every time you go in there and you set it up and get it right where you want it, Well, they turn around and monkey with things and basically don't want to respect your decision to use Flash. So, you know, you got to deal with that every doggone time you get in there. But hopefully, whenever I get this other deal situated, this won't be an issue anymore. I'm sitting here working on Firefox trying to find out. There it is right there. It's crazy. Let's see here. Do options. Alright, this is really getting on my doggone nerves. See, you know, try to say Flash isn't safe. So, man, this is bad for a doggone, this is bad for a doggone radio show. Really gets on my nerves. You can't just up and listen in. I don't want to update nothing, you jerks. I want you to leave me alone is what I want you to do. No. Alright. So anyway, I'm having issues over there trying to be able to let people listen in on my site over there. So if you're at Shaziz Radio, it's something in the doggone settings. Of course, you're probably not hearing me anyway because of this crazy deal. And so... And blast it. Alright. So anyway, I'm waiting for science to catch up, and I'm also waiting for Google to stop pulling shenanigans on me. It drives me insane, and so I'm like trying to get everything situated. But in the meantime, sometimes in order to go forward, you got to go backwards. So with that said, I'm going to play a bit of this podcast right here, and hopefully make it all make sense when it's all said and done. This is a story of electricity.
At the dawn of the 19th century, in a cellar in Mayfair, the most famous scientist of the time, Humphrey Davy, built an extraordinary piece of electrical equipment. 4 meters wide, twice as long, and containing stinking stacks of acid and metal. It had been created to pump out more electricity than had ever been possible before. It was, in fact, the biggest battery the world had ever seen. And with it, Davy was about to propel us into a new age. That moment would take place at a lecture at the Royal Institution in front of hundreds of London's great and good. Filled with anticipation, they packed the seats, hoping to witness a new and exciting electrical wonder. But what they would see that night would be something truly unique, something they'd remember for the rest of their lives. Using just 2 simple carbon rods, Humphrey Davy was about to unleash the true potential of electricity. Electricity is one of nature's most awesome phenomena, and the most powerful manifestation of it we ever see is lightning. This is the story of how we first dreamed of controlling this primal force of nature and how we would ultimately become its master. It's a 300-year tale of dazzling leaps of imagination and extraordinary experiments.
Tens of thousands of volts passed across his body and through the end of a lamp that he was holding.
It's a story of maverick geniuses who used electricity to light our cities, to communicate across the seas and through the air, to create modern industry, and to give us the digital revolution. But in this film, we'll tell the story of the very first scientists who started to unlock the mysteries of electricity. It was there something alive in there. They studied its curious link to life, built strange and powerful instruments to create it, and even tamed lightning itself. It was these men who truly laid the foundations of the modern world. And it all started with a spark. Imagine our world without electricity. It will be dark, cold, and quiet. In many ways, it will be like the beginning of the 18th century, where our story begins. This is the Royal Society in London. In the early 1700s, after years in the wilderness, Isaac Newton finally took control of it after the death of his arch-enemy, Robert Hooke. Newton brought in his own people to the key jobs to help shore up his new position. The new head of demonstrations there was 35-year-old Francis Hawkesby. Notes from the Royal Society in 1705 reveal how hard Hawkesby tried to stamp his personality on its weekly meetings, producing ever more spectacular experiments to impress his masters. In November, he came up with this, a rotating glass sphere. He was able to remove the air from inside it using a new machine, the air pump. On his machine, a handle allowed him to spin the sphere. One by one, the candles in the room were put out, and Francis placed his hand against the sphere. The audience were about to see something amazing. Inside the glass sphere, a strange ethereal light began to form, dancing around his hand. A light no one had ever seen before.
Oh, that's fantastic. You see, beautiful blue glow just marking out the shape of my hands, but then going right round the ball. It's as though there's something alive in there.
It's difficult to really understand why this dancing blue light meant so much. But we have to bear in mind that at the time, natural phenomena like this were seen to be the work of the Almighty.
This was still a...
Ah! Dad bless it. I swear, it gets on my nerves. Hold on, I'll get it back, hopefully. Ah! That's really kind of frustrating, folks. That burned people messing around with the doggone deal. Alright, well, I got Flash Player to work again. Ah! Alright, let's get back up there. Sorry about that. Let me see if I can get back to where I was.
Within 10 years, a new breakthrough was to come from an from the silk, and they fascinated him. Seeing blue light meant so much. But we have to bear in mind that at the time, natural phenomena like this were seen to be the work of the Almighty.
This was still a period when, even in Isaac Newton's theory, God was constantly intervening in the conduct of the world. And so it made sense for a lot of people to interpret natural phenomena as acts of God.
So when a mere mortal meddled with God's work, it was almost beyond rational comprehension. Hawkesby never realized the full significance of his experiment. He lost interest in his glowing sphere and spent the last few years of his life building ever more spectacular experiments for Isaac Newton to test his other theories. He never realized that he'd unwittingly started an electrical revolution. Before Hawkesby, electricity had been merely a curiosity. The ancient Greeks rubbed amber, which they called electron, to get small shocks. And even Queen Elizabeth I marveled at static electricity's power to lift feathers. But now, Hawkesby's machine could make electricity at the turn of a handle, and you could see it. And perhaps even more importantly, his invention coincided with the birth of a new movement sweeping across Europe, called the Enlightenment. Enlightened intellectuals used reason to question the world, and their legacy was radical politics, iconoclastic art, and natural philosophy, or science. But ironically, Hawkesby's new machine wasn't immediately embraced by most of these intellectuals, but instead by conjurers and street magicians. And those with an interest in electricity called themselves electricians. One story tells of a dinner party attended by an Austrian count. The electrician had placed some feathers on the table and then charged up a glass rod with a silk handkerchief. He then astonished the guests by lifting up the feathers with the rod. He then went on to charge himself up using one of Hawkesby's electrical machines and gave the guests electric shocks, presumably to squeals of delight. But for his pièce de résistance, he placed a glass of cognac in the centre of the table, charged himself up again, and lit it with a spark from the tip of his finger.
There was a trick called the electrical beatification, in which the victim sits on an insulated chair, and above his head hangs a metal crown that doesn't quite touch his head. And then if the crown is electrified, then you get an electric discharge around the crown that looks exactly like a halo, which is why it's called the electric beatification.
As England and the rest of Europe went electricity crazy, the spectacles grew bigger. And the more curious electricians started to ask more profound questions. Not only how can we make our shows bigger and better, but how can we control this amazing power? And for some, can this incredible electrical fire do more than just entertain? One of the first early breakthroughs would never have happened had it not been for a terrible accident. This is Charterhouse in the centre of London. Over the past 400 years, it's been a charitable home for young orphans and elderly gentlemen. And sometime in the 1720s, it also became home to one Stephen Gray. Stephen Gray had been a successful silk dyer from Canterbury. He was used to seeing electric sparks leap from the silk, and they fascinated him. Unfortunately, a crippling accident ended his career and left him destitute. But then he was offered a new life here at Charterhouse, and with it, the time to perform his own electrical experiments. Here at Charterhouse, possibly in this very room, the Great Chamber, Stephen Gray built a wooden frame. From the top beam, he suspended two swings using silk rope. He also had a device like this, a Hawkesby machine, for generating static electricity. Now, with a large audience in attendance, he got one of the orphan boys who lived here at Charterhouse to lie across the two swings. Gray placed some gold leaf in front of him. He then generated electricity and charged the boy through a connecting rod. Gold leaf, even feathers, leapt to the boy's fingers. Some of the audience claimed they could even see sparks flying out from his fingertips. Show business indeed. But to the curious and inquiring mind of Stephen Gray, this said something else as well. Electricity could move. From the machine to the boy's body, through to his hands. But the silk rope stopped it dead. It meant the mysterious electrical fluid could flow through some things, but not through others.
I'll pause that right there. That's before they actually figured out the Leyden jar and basically bringing into capacitor technology that I wanted to get in as well. The thing about it is waiting for science to catch up, because some of the experiments that I've been doing with my stuff is that if you go back and you look at my neodymium magnet accelerator, in the process of working with that, I figured out a few things that you didn't actually need near the amount of turns of wire, so there was something else going on with that deal, and the way that energy is actually stored in capacitors is basically the point that I'm about trying to get to here. So I'm gonna keep on playing a little bit more of this.
It led Gray to divide the world into two different kinds of substances. He called them insulators and conductors. Insulators held electric charge within them and wouldn't let it move, like the silk, or hair, glass, and resin, whereas conductors allowed electricity to flow through them, like the boy, or metals. It's a distinction which is still crucial even today. Just think of these electric pylons. They work on the same principle that Gray deduced nearly 300 years ago. The wires are conductors. The glass and ceramic objects between the wire and the metal of the pylon are insulators that stop the electricity leaking from the wires into the pylon and down to the earth. They're just like the silk ropes in Gray's experiment. Back in the 1730s, Gray's experiment may have astounded all who saw it, but it had a frustrating drawback. Try as he might, Gray couldn't contain the electricity he was generating for long. It leapt from the machine to the boy and was quickly gone. The next step in our story came when we learnt how to store electricity. But that would take place not in Britain, but across the channel in mainland Europe. Across the channel, electricians were just as busy as their British counterparts, and one centre for electrical research was here in Leiden, Holland. And it was here that a professor came up with an invention that many still regard as the most significant of the 18th century, one that, in some form or another, can still be found in almost every electrical device today. That professor was Pieter van Musschenbroek. Unlike Hawksby and Gray, Musschenbroek was born into academia. But ironically enough, his breakthrough came not because of his rigorous science, but because of a simple human mistake. He was trying to find a way to store electrical charge ready for his demonstrations, and you can almost hear his train of thought as he tries to figure this out. If electricity is a fluid that flows a bit like water, then maybe you can store it in the same way that you can store water. So Musschenbroek went to his laboratory to try to make a device to store electricity. Musschenbroek started to think literally. He took a glass jar and poured in some water. He then placed inside it a length of conducting wire, which was connected at the top to a Hawksby electric machine. Then he put the jar on an insulator to help keep the charge in the jar. He then tried to pour the electricity into the jar, produced by the machine, via the wire, down through into the water. But whatever he tried, the charge just wouldn't stay in the jar. Then one day, by accident, he forgot to put the jar on the insulator, but charged it instead while it was still in his hand. Finally, holding the jar with one hand, he touched the top with the other and received such a powerful electric shock, he was almost thrown to the ground. He writes, "It's a new but terrible experiment which I advise you never to try. Nor would I, who've experienced it and survived by the grace of God, do it again for all the kingdom of France. So I'm going to heed his advice, not touch the top, but instead see if I can get a spark off of it." The sheer power of the electricity which flew from the jar was greater than any seen before. And even more surprisingly, the jar could store that electricity for hours, even days. So in honor of the city where Musschenbroek made his discovery, they called it the Leyden jar. And its fame swept across the world.
And very rapidly from 1745 through the rest of the 1740s, the news of this, it's called the Leyden jar, goes global. It spreads from Japan in East Asia to Philadelphia in Eastern America. It became one of the first quick globalized scientific news items.
But although the Leyden jar became a global electrical phenomenon, no one had the slightest idea how it worked.
You have a jar of electric fluid, and it turns out that you get a bigger shock from the jar if you allow the electric fluid to drain away to the earth. Why is the shock bigger if the jar's leaking? Why isn't the shock bigger if you make sure that all the electric fluid stays inside the jar? That was how mid-18th century electrical philosophers were faced with this challenge.
Electricity was without doubt a fantastical wonder. It could shock and spark. It could now be stored and moved around. Yet what electricity was, how it worked, and why it did all these things, was nothing less than a complete mystery. Within 10 years, a new breakthrough was to come from an unexpected quarter, from a man politically and philosophically at war with the London establishment. And even more shockingly for the British electrical elite, that man was merely a colonial, an American. This painting of Benjamin Franklin hangs here at the Royal Society in London. Franklin was a passionate supporter of American emancipation and saw the pursuit of rational science, and particularly electricity, as a way of rolling back ignorance, false idols, and ultimately his intellectually elitist colonial masters.
And this is mixed with a profoundly egalitarian democratic idea that Franklin and his allies have, which is, this is a phenomenon open to everyone. Here's something that the elite doesn't really understand, and we might be able to understand it. Here's something that the elite can't really control, but we might be able to control. And here's something above all, which is the source of superstition. And we, rational, egalitarian, potentially democratic intellectuals, we will be able to reason it out without appearing to be the slaves of magic or mystery.
So Franklin decided to use the power of reason to rationally explain what many considered a magical phenomenon, lightning. This is probably one of the most famous scientific images of the 18th century. It shows Benjamin Franklin, the heroic scientist, flying a kite in a storm, proving that lightning is electrical. But although Franklin proposed this experiment, he almost certainly never performed it.
Much more likely is that his most significant experiment was another one, which he proposed but didn't even conduct. In fact, it didn't even happen in America. It took place here in a small village north of Paris called Marly-les-Villes.
The French adored Franklin, especially his anti-British politics, and they took it upon themselves to perform his other lightning experiments without him. I've come to the very spot where that experiment took place.
In May 1752, Georges-Louis Leclerc, known across France as the Comte de Buffon, and his friend Thomas-François Delibar erected a 40-foot metal pole, more than twice as high as this one, held in place by three wooden staves, just outside Delibar's house here in Marly-les-Villes. The metal pole rested at the bottom inside an empty wine bottle.
Franklin's big idea had been that the long pole would capture the lightning, pass it down the metal rod, and store it in the wine bottle at the base, which worked as a Leyden jar. Then he could confirm what lightning actually was. All his French followers had to do was wait for a storm. And then on May 23rd, the heavens opened.
At 12:20, a loud thunderclap was heard as lightning hit the top of the pole. An assistant ran to the bottle. A spark leapt across between the metal and his finger with a loud crack and a sulphurous smell, burning his hand.
The spark revealed lightning for what it really was. It was the same as the electricity made by man.
It's hard to overestimate the significance of this moment. Nature had been mastered. Not only that, but the wrath of God itself had been brought under the control of mankind. It was a kind of heresy.
Franklin's experiment was very important because it showed that lightning storms
produce or are produced by electricity, and that you can bring this electricity down, that electricity is a force of nature that's waiting out there to be tapped.
Next, Franklin turned his rational mind to another question. Why the Leyden jar made the biggest sparks when it was held in the hand? Why didn't all the electricity just drain away? And drawing on his experience as a successful businessman, he saw something no one else had. That, like money in a bank, electricity can be in credit, what he called positive, or debit, negative.
For him, the problem of the Leyden jar is a problem of accountancy. Franklin's idea was every body has around it an electrical atmosphere. And there's a natural amount of electric fluid around each body. If there's too much, we'll call it positive. If there's too little, we'll call it negative. And nature is organized so the positives and the negatives always want to balance out, like an ideal American economy.
Franklin's insight was that electricity was actually just positive charge flowing to cancel out negative charge. And he believed this simple idea could solve the mystery of the Leyden jar. As the jar is charged up, negative electrical charge is poured down the wire and into the water. If the jar rests on an insulator, a small amount builds up in the water. But if instead the jar is held by someone as it's being charged, positive electric charge is sucked up through their body from the ground to the outside of the jar, trying to cancel out the negative charge inside. But the positive and negative charges are stopped from cancelling out by the glass, which acts as an insulator. So instead, the charge just grows and grows on both sides of the glass. Then, touching the top of the jar with the other hand completes a circuit, allowing the negative charge on the inside to pass through the hand to the positive on the outside, finally cancelling it out. The movement of this charge causes a massive shock and often a spark. The modern equivalent of the Leyden jar is this, the capacitor, and it's one of the most ubiquitous of electronic components. It's found everywhere. There are a number of smaller ones scattered around on this circuit board from a computer. They help smooth out electrical surges, protecting sensitive components, even in the most modern electric circuit. Solving the mystery of the Leyden jar and recognizing lightning as merely a kind of electricity were two great successes for Franklin and the New Enlightenment movement.
Pause that for a second, because the reason why I want to play this particular podcast, because it goes back and talks about all the different things that they were working on trying to figure out electricity to begin with. But it gives you a lot of clues towards modern day, the way that we see electricity, the way electricity works and all. And so, you know, with that said, there's, you know, different opinions on what electricity actually really is. However, the modern day capacitors, they store basically the equivalence of a static charge, which is what they were doing back in them days, how they were able to get those sparks the way they were doing, and being able to store that energy like the Leyden jar. And so the way that we're using electricity right now, we call, you know, AC wave and AC current and DC current, but all of it, every single bit of it, it's all the same force. even an electrical discharge, such as a static discharge from your finger to that jar or vice versa, it produces a magnetic field that is measurable. So with that said, the way that we're using electricity right now is really super inefficient, and by understanding how this energy is actually traveling to begin with, then you can literally be able to store energy at a much larger quantity. And one of the other things that they had mentioned was that the path to ground thing that was going on, how the charge would get stronger in between where you had all your positive charge and where your negative charge would be in the ground. So whenever you made that circuit, you get a more powerful boost. That's because nature's slapping that back so rapidly that it produces a lot more power. So anyway, I'm going to play a little bit more of this right here. Yolant said, I think they running more electricity with the smart meters. We don't have one, but still think maybe we'll ask Shaziz about that. I honestly think that those smart meters are actually ripping people off, but that's just me. I'll have to do more research to find out. But the old version of the deals, they worked on induction in order to be able to measure how much current you use, how much voltage or watts per hour or whatever. And so with that said, everyone just want to be able to squeeze out every single little penny that they can possibly get using newer digital technology, plus the fact that they don't actually have to send nobody out to the actual meter to have it tested and such. So Yolant said, Shaziz, at night can hear buzzing in the air. We live in a very rural area, and smart meters were put in last January. Are they running more electricity through the public lines? I'm not exactly sure. I don't think there's more electricity. I think it's just a type of circuitry, and the way that they're actually doing it's actually causing that extra hum that you get. It's kind of like those transformers. If you listen really close to those transformers, they're actually doing a little bit of humming too. Anyway, let me get back on with this right here.
But the forces of trade and commerce, which helped fuel the Enlightenment, were about to throw up a new and even more perplexing electrical mystery. A completely new kind of electricity.
This is the English Channel. By the 17th and 18th centuries, a good fraction of the world's wealth flowed up this stretch of water from all corners of the British Empire and beyond, on its way to London. Spices from India, sugar from the Caribbean, wheat from America, tea from China. But of course, it wasn't just commerce.
New plant and animal specimens from all over the world came flooding into London, including one that particularly fascinated the electricians. Called the torpedo fish, it'd been the stuff of fishermen's tales. Its sting, it was said, was capable of knocking a grown man down. But as the electricians started to investigate the sting, they realized it felt strangely similar to a shock from a Leyden jar. Could its sting actually be an electric shock?
At first, many people dismissed the torpedo fish's shock as occult. Some said it was probably just the fish biting. Others that it couldn't be a shock because without a spark, it just wasn't electricity. But for most, this was a very strange and inexplicable new mystery. And it would take one of the oddest, yet most brilliant characters in British science to begin to unlock the secrets of the torpedo fish.
This is the only picture in existence of the pathologically shy but exceptional Henry Cavendish. This one only exists because an artist sketched his coat as it hung on a peg, then filled in the face from memory. His family were fantastically rich. They were the Devonshires, who still own Chatsworth House in Derbyshire. But Henry Cavendish decided to turn his back on his family's wealth and status, to live in London near his beloved Royal Society, where he could quietly pursue his passion for experimental science. When he heard about the electric torpedo fish, he was intrigued. A friend wrote to him, "On this, my first experience of the effect of the torpedo..."
I'm gonna pause this. They're actually with that torpedo fish. We would know of more like electric eels, but they were discovering basically battery technology by this time around there. But something that Yolance is talking about inside there, I did a video quite some time back. I can't remember the actual name of it, but in this video you could see every time there was a pulse of electricity that those wires would jump. And so what's going on in that wire is that you have, every time you run a current through there, you get a magnetic field that is basically pushed around that wire. And depending on, you know, how you're actually running this electricity will determine the actual strength of it. That's why I was trying to get to earlier about how I was able to take one single wire, and run it through six separate coils and be able to get over 200 and some odd volts from every single one of these coils. Because that magnetic field, the coils, they're only looking for a change in polarity. And each one of those wires that are, each one of the windings that are laying towards each other, you know, upside of each other, every time you're trying to push electricity through there, or allow the electricity to flow through there, they're producing their own magnetic field. And as they're expanding and collapsing, that could cause that buzzing noise that you're hearing about, and depending on the type of frequency that they're actually pulsing this electricity at. So between the materials that they make them out of nowadays, and between the way that they're actually using the energy, you could actually get some buzzing going on. That the buzzing that you hear in your normal little transformers is that magnetic field expanding and collapsing and basically causing a hum. If you put your ear up to one of those transformers, you can actually hear that hum that you're talking about. Well, I don't really know any way around that outside of using electricity differently, where you're not overpowering the circuit. This is what I'm trying to get to. We don't need near the amount of power that the power companies are pushing to us. They're trying to push as much as they possibly can to us so that they can sell more. It's obvious the more they say you use, the more you have to pay for. But the system that I'm working on is going to show people a different way of using electricity, and I'm going to put together some simple circuits to show that you don't need near the amount of power to actually run each appliance. You got anywhere from 120 to 220 volts AC coming out of your wall outlet, depending on where you're at, and between 50 hertz to 60 hertz range is what they're pulsing these things at. And so with that said, that's a whole lot more energy than is necessary to induce a current from the primary coil to the secondary coil. That one single wire that I talked about shows that field is a lot more powerful than it you think. You would think that for a primary coil you'd have to have multiple turns in order to make that magnetic field strong enough to actually induce a current into the secondary, but that's not the case. What I've shown with my neodymium magnet accelerator, that a one single wire system has enough magnetic flux in it to literally energize between the ferrite core and the actual windings themselves. All it's looking for, that's what I've been saying all day long, is all it's looking for is that change in polarity. And the humming that you're hearing basically is things rattling back and forth. You know, it's vibrating it, and so that vibration is a tone that's coming off of the hum. Is the tone that's coming off from the vibration of those magnetic fields expanding and collapsing at such a rapid rate. So there might be ways that you could actually deaden that sound around you and potentially even recapture some of that wasted energy, because that's what you're hearing right there is wasted energy. If the magnetic field is that strong and it doesn't need to be that strong, then that means a lot of that is turning out to be wasted energy. I'd be kind of interested if I was in your neighborhood to kind of look and see and run a thermal one of those digital thermometers on the wires and stuff like that to see what their actual temperature is, because if what I'm suspecting is going on is probably using more power than it's actually needing, which is being translated into heat loss and being wasted. The system that I'm working on is set to completely reduce the heat loss altogether by only pushing to each appliance what it actually requires in order to run that given appliance. So we don't need near the amount of power that's coming to these things. And so with that said, the most of the energy that they send to us in our homes is getting wasted. It's not being used. If you could reach down and grab a hold of that transformer, and that transformer is warm or hot to the touch, then that means that it's got too much power coming to it. There's no place for that power to go, and that's why that doggone thing is basically building up. It's almost the equivalence of how you'd explain when you compress a gas that by smashing all those molecules together, you're generating heat. It's basically the same thing. You know, you're trying to shove too much energy down into these transformers, and they don't require near the amount of current that you're trying to push to them, and that's why they actually get losses in the system, which generates the heat. Now, a lot of what I say is probably going against what mainstream is talking about, but I have a mechanical understanding of how this energy is actually moving around. That's why I can sit here and try to explain this to you in simpler terms, because it's quite literally not rocket science. It's basically, if you understand how water moves around, then you and even air pressure for that matter, then you also understand electrical pressure as well. You understand how electricity works, and so it can be stored, it can be pressurized, and you know, you get a large quantity of water in a tank. You got a lot of pressure in there, and depending on the path that you give it to wherever you want to send it, you know, the size of the pipe is going to determine the actual current flow. And so if you got a system that is pushing too much current to something, and you give that extra current that the thing can't use a place to go, then that basically will make a storage, a surplus of energy that's left over. And so, you know, by making things inefficient and wasteful, the power company is able to make a whole lot of money. You know, like they say, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Well, you know that whenever you run your electrical fan for long periods of time, it starts to get hot, you know, because it's too much power going to it. And you can even hear some humming to that motor. You know, if you can get close enough to that motor, you can hear the humming in there as well. It's vibrating the crud out of it. It don't need to be doing that. It only needs to be able to detect that change in polarity. Those two magnetic fields will interact with each other depending on whether it's they're facing opposite each other, north and south, or they're facing, you know, like opposites attract, and the same will repel. So, with that said, that basic understanding of electricity means that you know that those magnetic fields, they don't have to extend well past, you know, the part they're trying to turn. They only have to have that that change in polarity to make the difference, whether it's going to be an attraction or repulsion, you know, by dissimilar or like whichever. So there might be a way to resolve that buzzing, and if science ever catches up, then you wouldn't even be able to hear that energy moving around. And so normally you wouldn't hear electricity anyway, you'd hear the effects of what's going on, but buzzing that you hear in transformers or ballast, like in your fluorescent lighting or whatever, that is because those things are literally vibrating. You're figuring a magnetic field is expanding and collapsing, and it's basically like shaking your coffee table while your coffee mug's on there. You're going to get some audible sound out of it. But used properly, you only need that change in polarity, and it would drastically reduce any of that. So, you know, the thing about it is everything has a thermal breakdown point. And when you're using energy the way that the power company's sending it to us, eventually something gets hot and it reaches its thermal breakdown point, and that's when our appliances begin to fail. Our computers, they don't need near the amount of power that we're shoving to them, so we got to find ways to restrict that flow so that those transistors and processors in there don't get hot and burn. I mean, after all, they're only made of silicone, and so when they get to a certain temperature, they're going to fail. They don't need near the amount of power that we're pushing to them, but there's no way set right now, the way that we're doing it, to regulate that power. Now, if you put a system in there like I'm talking about, you'll actually be able to regulate the power, and it will only be used in whatever power it's needed to actually run that device, and so that means all your devices will stay cooler. You got bearings inside there that, they got a little bit of lubricant on there, and for the most part, but there are some that are just kind of like softer metals that they actually are like self-lubricating, almost like what they make cutting boards out of. I can't remember, it's the type of plastic, but it's really slick. But if it's got a lubricant in there and the motor itself is getting hot, then that will reduce the viscosity of that oil, making that oil thinner and eventually wearing on your parts. Not to mention the fact that, if you got dust in your room and that dust is getting sucked through the back of the fan and it's plugging things up, that's going to help to raise that temperature. So it's always good to clean out the back of those fans, and even in your computers every once in a while, take your computers apart and blow out all the dust off of all the heat sinks and everything like that so that they can have the proper cooling that they need in order to, so they don't reach their thermal breakdown and fail. Alright, so I'm going to play just a little bit of more of this, and then I'm going to move on to something else. But I wanted to play some of the history, the story of electricity, because it actually, when you go back and listen to what they were doing back and then, what they were talking about, what they were saying, it starts to make sense what I'm trying to be explaining to people about how energy is actually moving around, and how with existing technology we can get better use out of the energy that we do use, and so we're not going to be allowing the power company to do things the way they do it. We're going to regulate that power once it comes into our homes before we ever even use it, so that we're not using near the amount of power that they expect us to use. Of course, they're going to try to accuse us of stealing electricity, but we're not. Once it comes through that doggone outlet, we paid for it. It's ours at that point. And what we do with it from that point on is our business. And so by making safe systems that will interact with our devices, that will only let that device have how much power that it actually needs to do the job, and it's going to be really easy for us to test to see how many volts, how much it actually requires to do that job without things getting hot. And so I'll be able to show that to everybody and post a video on it. Make sure that everybody knows that, how ridiculously simple it is to cut back on that by, only allowing so much to go to the appliance and the rest of it gets shifted on down to the next appliance in line.
Pedo, I exclaimed that this is certainly electricity. But how? And to work out how a living thing could produce electricity, he decided to make his own artificial fish. These are his plans. Two Leyden jars shaped like the fish, which were buried under sand. When the sand was touched, they discharged, giving a nasty shock. His model helped convince him that the real torpedo fish was electric, but it still left him with a nagging problem. Although both the real fish and Cavendish's artificial one gave powerful electric shocks, the real fish never sparked. Cavendish was perplexed. How could it be the same kind of electricity if they didn't both do the same kinds of things? Cavendish spent the winter of 1773 in his laboratory trying to come up with an answer. And in the spring, he had a brainwave. Cavendish's ingenious answer was to point out a subtle distinction between the amount of electricity and its intensity. The real fish produced the same kind of electricity, it's just that it was less intense. Now, for a physicist like me, this marks a crucial turning point, because it's the moment when two genuinely innovative scientific ideas first crop up. What Cavendish refers to as the amount of electricity, we now call electric charge. And his intensity is what we call the potential difference, or voltage. So the Leyden jar's shock was high voltage but low charge, whereas the fish was low voltage and high charge. And it's possible to actually measure that. Hiding at the bottom of this tank under the sand is the Torpedo Marmorata, and it's an electric ray. You can just see its eyes protruding from the sand. This is a fully grown female, and I'm going to try and measure the electricity it gives off with this bait. I've got this fish connected to a metal rod and hooked up to an oscilloscope to see if I can measure the voltage as it catches its prey. So here goes. There's one. And there's another one. The fish gave a shock of about 240 volts, the same as mains electricity, but still roughly 10 times less than the Leyden jar. Well, that would have given me quite a nasty shock. And I can only try and imagine what it must have been like for scientists in the 18th century to witness this. An animal, a fish, producing its own electricity. Cavendish had shown that the torpedo fish made electricity, but he didn't know if it was the same kind of electricity as that made from an electrical machine.
Is the electrical shock that a torpedo produces, is it the same as produced by an electrical machine? Or are there two kinds? Is there a kind that's generated artificially, or is there a kind of animal electricity that only exists in living bodies? And this was a huge debate that divided opinion for several decades.
And out of that bitter debate came a new discovery. The discovery that electricity needn't be a brief shock or spark, but could actually be continuous. And the generation of continuous electricity would ultimately propel us into our modern age.
All right, so if I could be a mediator between the old school electricity, what you just heard, and modern day science, we get there a lot faster than what we're doing. So I'm waiting for science to catch up, because everything that I've studied, I've found an understanding of how energy actually travels. I see it in a mechanical way, and the way that I'm trying to explain it to everybody is trying to be as simple as possible without using some crazy high-tech terminology. if you go out there and you look into electricity, you're going to hear a lot of different mathematical equations and all that other kind of stuff. But in reality, electricity is a lot simpler than what the science books explain it as. And you know, that's why I like to go back, in time as far as listening to this, like these types of documentaries, to what they were thinking back in the day. And how that relates to the realities of what we figured out so far. And so they figured out that they could store energy. They figured out that they could get real time current out of all of this right here. And so those were probably the best days of science back in the day, where they were actually testing stuff, as opposed to the way things seem to be done nowadays. You know, you got those so-called laws of physics that like to be like a brick wall in front of people to try to tell you, oh, this ain't possible, that ain't possible. Well, there was a time in history where they thought, electricity was magic. You know, it was magical. It was some dark force or whatever. And even to today, they're not really exactly 100% sure of what electricity really is, or magnetism for that matter. There's theories on everything, but at this stage in the game, it's all theoretical. But nonetheless, if you actually look and see the actual reactions, and you're paying attention to the mechanicals, the mechanics of what's actually occurring, then things start to fall in place. And we have technologies today as far as the way that batteries charge and discharge, and the difference between capacitors and the way that the old style capacitors as opposed to the new style capacitors, going all the way back from the Leyden jar all the way up to the modern day supercapacitors, the differences and the similarities will be the part where it actually gives you the little aha moment, the light bulb coming on. Modern-day supercapacitors work more like a battery. They actually have an electrolyte inside there, which for the purposes of being able to store extra power, but not just that, the way that they're designed, using different types of technology like graphene technology, carbon papers and stuff like that, they're able to have a larger surface area. And that is the key to that storage, even going back to the Leyden jar, and the way that power wants to balance itself back out, and they realize that once they connected it to earth ground, that power was magnified by a lot more, because it's a sudden release of that energy to balance itself out, or back down to earth ground or whatever. The negative and the positive, they want to be balanced out, be equal across the plane. You got a whole lot of positive charge on one plate, and you got a negative charge on the other plate. They have to balance themselves out. And so when that capacitor is storing a higher charge on one plate, it's just waiting for a path to the other side. But nonetheless, it's still all the same exact energy, whether we're talking about static electricity, lightning, AC power, or DC power. It's the same exact force. It's just the way that we're moving it around, at the speed at which we're moving around, the frequency at which we release this energy. Everything from like the telegraph to the radios, and the way that audio can be translated into an electrical signal, which basically is decoded on the other side in reverse of how you send it out. So it is ridiculously simple. It's not even rocket science. You could do the same thing with water. I've actually transmitted electricity using sound waves, because I understood how that wave and how everything's working. If you take a coil of wire and you run it back and forth across the magnet, then you get that induction of that current inside the wire. And vice versa, if you run the wire across the magnet, you know, whichever one, as long as you got that motion, it's that change in polarity that's occurring that is producing that electricity that we call it. But we have technology nowadays to actually take any given power source and be able to take that energy and to basically pulse, you know, coils without any kind of motion whatsoever. It's just the way that the transistor works, turning the switch on and off, but there's actually no motion involved. We're just using that stored energy to actually pulse coils, doing the same exact thing that you would do if you was trying to turn a generator, but without the mechanical portion of it. And so that's how inverters change that DC current into AC current. Well, as well as that, then you know that if you studied into the Tesla coil and how it actually works, it's basically the same thing. You can make a mechanical Tesla coil that will take magnets, run them across the doggone coil of wire, and as that's happening, you can change that current from either high voltage, low current, or vice versa, depending on how you want to use that energy on the other side. But by making a mechanical one, we were able to have a distributor in our car that would fire our spark plug. So essentially what you're seeing inside of some call them magnetos, some call them whatever, but it's the same concept. By turning that switch on and off, by changing that polarity, you can ramp that voltage up and you can bring it into any frequency range you want. And the cool thing about high voltage is that it isn't meeting the resistance of what current would. You try to shove a lot of current through a thin wire, and obviously that wire is going to get hot because it can't withstand that much power being shoved to it. But with high voltage, it'll travel down that wire without any kind of resistance whatsoever. It's the resistance that causes the heat, and that's what's happening in your transformers and your appliances, is that your appliances are actually resisting the amount of power that you're trying to shove to them, and because they don't need that much. You know, and it don't take near the amount of power in order to make these things turn. By turning the power way up, you might briefly get that motor to spin faster, but it's going to generate so much heat because it's got way too much power coming to it. And if you go look into the way that the RC motors, the brushless DC motors work these days, they're amazing on how long that they will actually run off of the newer type of battery technology, and even the power that they actually have, like cordless drills and such. You know, the amount of torque that is available for them. And you don't see these things getting extremely hot, and, so there's something to be noticed there. So anyway, I want to move on to something else here about capacitors. There's a lot more to this particular Story of Electricity documentary, but that's the first portion that I wanted to get to. But if you want to see this, I posted a link at shazizradio.com to this particular video. All these videos, podcasts that I play on here, I always post them over there in the chat room. Anyway, I'll start with this one right here. Work my way up.
Hi, Lee Teschler with Design World and EE World. I'm here with Kyle Kim from Eaton, and we're talking about supercapacitors. Kyle, first of all, what's the difference between a supercapacitor and a regular capacitor with just a couple of plates and an insulator between them?
So the supercapacitor has about 1,000 times more energy densities than the regular capacitors. The way we achieve it is by having a special material that has a high surface area, and then reduce the distance between the charges using the ions. So that's how we achieve that to the higher energy density.
Okay, I'll pause that just for a second. When he said that they got special materials in there with a lot more surface area, If you look underneath a microscope at any given surface, just a regular piece of metal, it's going to be a more smooth surface on there. But if you look underneath the microscope at a graphene type of deal, you'll notice that there's a lot of peaks on there, a lot more surface area. Even though it appears at the eye level to be flat and smooth, there's a lot more places for energy to actually be stored on, so the density can be increased that way. And this is what he's talking about whenever he's explaining these supercapacitors.
Well, keeping the power density same.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Now, supercapacitors are known for being able to supply a big burst of current real quick.
Correct.
But capacitors can't do that. Why the difference?
Because of the high energy density that contains on the supercapacitor while keeping the power density low enough, so they could discharge the high current really fast. While the regular capacitors may be able to provide the power but very short of time, so it does not have enough energy density to provide enough power.
Interesting. Now, we've got a couple of examples of supercaps right in front of us here. Why don't you tell us what we're looking at?
So these are the modules. So it comes with single cells, start with the single cells, and we package them into what the customer needs. So one of these is more stationary applications, typically for the UPSs or indoor applications. And this is a ruggedized the module that could go into the vehicles or even, the harsh environment.
About how much capacity do we have in front of us here?
So this one has a 62 volt, 130 farad capacitance. This product has a 48 volt and 166 farad.
What would you use these for?
So this thing is very useful for the short-term UPSs. So a lot of UPS requirements getting shorter as a minute to a second. So this one fits really well, replacing the batteries. And these one will be going something like the EVs or the hybrids to provide the short-term powers or the short-term energies that requires for the engine starting or capturing the energy from the braking.
I see. Kyle, if you incorporated this in a hybrid vehicle, could you reduce the size of the battery that you would normally use?
Yes, they can. It does two things. So first of all, it can capture more energies from braking or accelerating, probably more powers. And so they don't need that big size of the battery. So they would place some of the battery with this, and they can actually run more efficiently, and also it extends the battery life.
I see. Kyle, what kinds
of... All right, pause that for a second, because what he just said was that it extends the battery life, and the reason why... adding a buffer between the battery and your load or even the battery and your generator is because a battery can't charge and discharge as rapidly as a capacitor. These supercapacitors have more storage capability, so they're able to store more power and they're able to be charged faster. So at that stage in the game, if you got a buffer before the battery, after your generator, and you got a buffer after the battery before your load, then that means the capacitors themselves are actually carrying the load. They're able to charge and discharge rapidly, so at that stage in the game, your battery is only there as a backup to keep the current steady. And so you don't have to worry about your battery getting hot any longer. And you won't destroy your battery because you're, overcharging it or undercharging it, charging it and discharging it too far down. There are batteries out there called deep cycle batteries that you can bring them all the way down to like 20% of the full battery capacity without even hurting that type of battery. Now, with a normal lead acid battery or even nickel cadmium, nickel metal hydride, or lithium ion batteries, you can't do that, because they'll start to develop a memory one way or another, and you'll never be able to go full charge up again, and eventually the battery's bad. It won't, be able to put up as much. But by incorporating capacitor technology in with these batteries and using a buffer between everything that battery is trying to run the power on, you make your batteries last multitudes times longer. So if your average car battery would last a couple years, at the way you're using it now, then you're talking magnitudes longer, anywhere from 10 to 20 years per battery because it's not going to degrade nearly as fast as it would have otherwise, because you're charging it and you're discharging it. Sometimes you have peaks in your charge and you get overcharging on it, and if you're not using that that energy at a steady flow as it's coming in, you know, your alternator is supposedly just there to maintain your battery, but for the most part, your alternator is carrying the load because of how much energy that you're trying to use at any given time. But the thing is that once you get past a certain point, your alternator starts to bog down, which causes everything else to have to work harder as well, including the battery. And, you know, there's limitations to the way they're doing it right now. But with the type of system that I'm talking about, your alternator would rarely have to kick on, which means your alternator would last a lot longer, and your battery would last a lot longer, and you'd keep a constant, steady flow of energy, and the things that the loads that you're running off of it, you know, wouldn't, you know, reach their thermal breakdown. Now, if you're obviously using an incandescent bulb, or you know, the halogen bulbs with the incandescent element inside there, those are designed to have resistance to them, and so they're supposed to get hot. It's the other ones that you don't want to get hot. You know, your LEDs, you got too much current going to those LEDs. They don't require near the amount of power that we're trying to shove to them, so we got to figure out ways to try to cool them down by making like built-in heat sinks on the backs of these LEDs or whatever, so that they don't get too much current and burn out. We actually have to put resistors before LEDs so that it resists the current flow. So that tells you it don't need near the amount of power that you're trying to shove to it. So there's ways by using this type of technology to literally only give those LEDs what they require in order to be able to put the power out. And so all these different systems that I'm talking about, the way that we're running electricity right now is destructive. We're pushing too much power. It's causing things to get hot. They reach the thermal breakdown. They fail. And we're out there buying new products and stuff. But with this type of method, your computers, your electric motors, and everything's going to last a whole lot longer. And then if you go out to get you solar or wind power, that you're going to get the maximum amount of energy available. If that solar power can produce 100 watts, then you're going to get that full 100 watts worth of power and in storage. And so if you're only using 50 watts, you're constantly got plenty in the background waiting around to be used. And you know, all it is that you're waiting to that energy is waiting to be balanced back out. So it's looking for, you know, an open circuit. It's looking for a path to ground, and that's how ridiculously simple it is. It's not rocket science. Let me finish this one here up.
Supercaps is heat supply. So Eaton has a variety of supercaps. So I can show you the smaller parts that we have. So it starts with the 0.1 farad all the way up to 3,000 farads on the single cells. And we also provide custom packaging requirements for the customer's need. And obviously we have these larger modules that goes up to 3,000 farad cells and combine them together.
Kyle, that's interesting technology. Thanks for telling us about it and telling us a little bit more about how supercapacitors work.
Well, thank you so much for the time.
So anyway, it's exciting because the modern day, the capacitor technology is basically getting mind-blowing. The moment science and technology catch up and start paying attention to the kind of things I'm trying to share with everybody, we're gonna see some exciting times as far as energy goes. But in the meantime, for the average Joe out there, it's ridiculously simple to make a capacitor. Once you know different types of materials and the difference between just a regular sheet of metal or, whether it be aluminum or copper or whatever, and, the way that the difference between, like, graphene, carbon, or whatever, because of the way that the molecules are made up in graphene and carbon, is that there's more surface area for those electrons to be able to be stored on. The more energy, the more surface area, the better. And they've gotten really good at making little tiny capacitors that you could hold in the palm of your hand, be able to have a whole lot more surface area on them because of the types of materials that they're actually using. And they're actually kind of a supercapacitor or ultracapacitor would be more like a battery than you would think. It doesn't work exactly the same way, but they're more like a battery. So if I had an easy way to explain this between the difference of a regular capacitor and a supercapacitor, it's like a hybrid battery/capacitor, and they actually make what they call bat caps, which is a battery and a capacitor all built into one deal, and those are for like diesel engines or whatever in cold weather, so that they got this instant really heavy duty punch where it can release energy really fast in order to be able to turn that thing over in really cold weathers. Anyway, so that technology is really impressive. Let's listen to this one right here.
Researchers recently and quite accidentally discovered something that could change the whole electric car ballgame. If their predictions are accurate, we could one day live in a world where cars can be fully charged in minutes instead of hours, and their power storage units would last decades instead of years. What is this tantalizing breakthrough, you ask? A monumental leap forward in capacitor technology. Many of the current drawbacks of electric cars stem from how batteries work. Batteries rely on chemical reactions, which means for a lithium-ion battery to release energy, you have to wait for the lithium to shuffle through an electrolyte, and then when you want to store energy, you have to wait for the lithium to shuffle back. Lithium-ion batteries also degrade, and replacing one in an electric car would be enormously expensive. In contrast, capacitors store static electricity, like what builds up on a balloon when you rub it on your hair. Capacitors can be as simple as two metal plates separated by air. When a current is applied to the plates, a positive charge builds up on one plate and a negative charge builds up on the other. No electrolytes, no shuffling ions, just charged electrons waiting to pounce like a caged lion. As a result, capacitors can be fully charged almost instantly. And since they can also deliver energy quickly, that means capacitors can provide more power than batteries. They are much more durable than lithium-ion batteries too, lasting through tons of charge and discharge cycles with little degradation. There is an Achilles heel, though. They just can't hold very much energy. There are tricks to squeeze more charge onto the plates, like increasing their surface area and reducing the distance between them by swapping out the air with a thin insulator. Do that and you've created a supercapacitor. But even the best supercapacitors today hold just 10 watt-hours per kilogram, which is about 5% of the energy density of a lithium-ion battery of the same weight. You would need a capacitor the size of a bus to get any real use out of it. As it happens, in 2010, Shanghai experimented with electric buses powered by capacitors that charged up every couple of stops. That's a pretty clever use of them, but if you want a personal car smaller than a bus that can travel more than 5 miles without stopping, capacitors are going to have to step up their game. Bizarrely, the big breakthrough in supercapacitor technology may come from contact lenses. Soft contacts use a polymer mesh that can swell up and store water. One of the original inventors has been tinkering with the polymer ever since and found that by adding different elements, it imbues it with different properties, like the ability to store electricity. Actually, they were shocked at just how much energy the polymer could store. A 2016 test of the little blue material found it stored 100 times the energy the researchers expected. Since then, they've been testing the material to see if it works in real-world conditions, and after 14 months of research, have concluded that the material could eventually store 180 watt-hours per kilogram, putting it almost on par with battery energy density, at least by weight. The supercapacitors could be quite a bit more voluminous, perhaps 30% bigger than an equivalent battery. Still, they'd be faster to charge, cheaper to make, and wouldn't have the risk of catching fire since they'd be mostly water. They could also have applications outside of cars, like storing energy for when it's in high demand, or when renewable sources aren't generating electricity. For now, regular old chemical batteries are still the best fit for electric cars. But if this is the breakthrough the researchers believe it is, batteries could be on their way out in the next decade. In a weird way, soft contacts may have helped us see a brighter future. If you like what we do, don't forget to subscribe. Just because capacitors are improving doesn't mean we're not developing new and better batteries too, like a squishy battery. You can learn more about that here. None other than Elon Musk himself has said that supercapacitors are the future of electric cars, but you know, he also thought a tiny submarine would help, so, you know, grain of salt and all that. Thanks for watching, and I'll see you...
Anyway, so he's basically saying that, you know, while the capacitor technology is getting better, that they don't have the capability of storing. But what he's missing out is the fact that these things can be charged rapidly. So if you understand what I've been talking about as far as high voltage and the way that we're moving energy from point A to point B, it wouldn't take you long at all to basically keep that thing fully charged up at running at higher voltages, potentially even at lower frequencies than what we do right now. You know, from we're running at 50-60 hertz, but we could actually run it at lower frequencies and be able to charge those things up rapidly. And so those are the types of experiments that I want to show everybody so that they can see that what I'm talking about is, you know, it's based on actual science, proven science. You take all this stuff right here and add it into conjunction with each other, modern day electrical vehicles, they will be able to charge themselves as they're driving down the road. There's more than enough energy available, and by using the energy differently and not trying to cram too much power to the system, once you open the floodgates of that current going through there, you know, it's a constant flow, and those motors don't need near the amount of power that we're shoving to them. That's what I've been trying to say all along. People think that you got to shove more current to it in order to get it to go faster. You'll get it to go faster for a brief period of time, but you're also going to have losses in the system greater than the capability of actually charging them up the way that you're doing it now. If you understand how to charge these things up without shoving too much current to it, your normal battery can't keep up with that kind of demand. But if you put a buffer between every one of these motors and the charging system, then you have an excess of storage. And if your surface area is larger, greater in numbers than the actual amount of power that you're using, then that means that any excess energy is not going to be shoved towards the plants that you want to run. It'll give that surplus inside there. You can use a 1,000-watt capacitor to run a 9-volt deal. You just have to understand. You got this thing already connected to it. It's when you're charging it up, it's already using that on demand. It has that extra space in there, and it'll never be able to fill completely up because you're draining it off constantly. This is one of the things that I showed in my experiments of how I'm running things off of capacitors with absolutely no battery involved in the entire circuit, that energy can travel, you know, without backing up on itself. Once it starts backing up, you get, you know, this excess power, and then essentially, you know, you start burning things out. But if you're never overcharging that tank, there's no way you're going to burn that out. It's allowing that power to be drained off, you know, at a more harmonious rate without, you know, you trying to shove too much current down through there. So a thin wire is all that it takes in order to get the amount of voltage necessary to run most of these things. And that's what with that neodymium magnet accelerator, once I get that next update to that on there, you'll see what I'm saying, that we don't even need near the amount of copper wire that we're using. So if you go look at, I did a video where I took a computer hard drive and I spun that thing up, and I was able to run a whole entire 120-volt strand of LED lighting off of a computer hard drive by spinning it up to about 35 to 50,000 RPM using a Dremel. It may not even have had that much RPM, but that's what the Dremel was actually capable of. But either way, spinning it up, factoring in that I even had slippage going on, because I was just using the buffer wheel to spin it, but it was able to put that much energy out to light that entire strand that normally when you plug it into the wall outlet, the doggone thing would be getting warm because there's too much current flowing to it, and it has to have some sort of resistor in there to keep some of that current back so that it won't burn those LEDs out. However, by running it the way that I ran it, that LED strand put out just as much light as it would have otherwise. However, there wasn't no heat losses in it. It was running nice and cool. Just like the system that I'm running with the DDS signal generator and the microwave oven transformer or down to the bridge rectifier using the same capacitors that I've been talking about and such, I'm able to move an AC current down through there with very little current, if any at all, and I'm just basically using just the voltage portion of it because voltage is the pressure, and that pressure will go through the same capacitors. You don't need current. Matter of fact, the capacitors that I'm using to pack a punch before it actually gets to the bridge rectifier to change it from the AC wave to the DC wave, they're not set to run on large current for long periods of time. So when you start your electric motor, they're actually kicked out of the circuit, and then it switches from that type of capacitor to a regular run capacitor that can handle that much current to it. And so with that said, the way that I'm running this power through there, I'm building up pressure and getting it down there. So I start off with a 5-volt input, and then on the outside, pushing about 9 volts using the 60 hertz square wave. And I'm packing a punch, able to push out over 100 volts into these capacitors. And since there's plenty of storage space, I never have to worry about overcharging these capacitors. I can keep enough pressure inside there to run smaller capacitors to keep those fully charged at all times. So by the time it's all said and done, I have real-time current on demand with something that shouldn't be because of the amount of energy that I've actually put into it. So they say you can't never get out more than you put in. Well, I've been trying to argue for a long time that it don't matter whether you get out more than you put in. That 5 volts is capable of doing a whole lot more than what you think it is. It's just the way that you're using that energy that's making the difference. And so if you understand how that energy is traveling, you understand what you can do with that energy. That's why I got a circuit board, which is the DDS signal generator, that is turning that 5 volts on and off rapidly. And using the transformer, the primary is actually gathering that signal, and all it's looking for is a change in polarity. You don't need a lot of current to do it. It's just looking for a change in polarity. And so when it gets its change in polarity, it induces a current into the secondary, which in turn, because of the number of turns on there and the thinness of the wire, is ramping the voltage up and dropping the current down, which is exactly what I wanted. And that high voltage is then in turn pressurizing the capacitors, which in turn is going through the rectifier, which changes it from an AC signal to a DC. And so that is able to charge the capacitors, which then in turn bleed over into supercapacitors. And then if I want from that point on, I can use those supercapacitors to bleed over into a regular battery system, and the battery won't never get hot. So everything from that point on is, it stays cool because I understand how that energy is traveling, and I'm only giving to the any given appliance the amount of power that's necessary. What significance this makes is that we'll be able to, with the amount of power that we've got coming in our house, we should be able to run 3 or 4 houses off of the amount of power that we're using in this house, if not more. And when you buy solar panel setups, you won't need near as many solar panels because you're using that energy in a completely different fashion than trying to drag it direct. See, the solar panel setup goes into an inverter system, which takes the DC from the solar and actually turns it into an AC. And then that's what runs your appliances and such. And then if you have a battery in between that, you actually have to have a charge controller, because those are going to continuously, as long as the sun's out, keep on pushing power to it, and the batteries can't take that. They need they need to shut that power off so that you, when those batteries are fully charged, you're just wasting energy at that point. The sun's still pushing energy to the solar panels. You just shut the circuit off so that you're not overcharging it. So if you was able to get 100% of that solar panel instead of what you're getting now, you would have a surplus of electricity. They actually got it set up right now to where the way that their systems are setting, that they're a lot more efficient than actually having a battery. They can actually run these directly into your basically a grid tie system. And so these solar panels are able to push out enough power with the inverters that they've got that can run your entire house and start to at some point spin your meter backwards whenever you're not using near the amount of power that they're capable of. Then that adds a surplus to your basically account for your electric bill, and so reduced by that, either reducing or eliminating completely your electric bill. And using the system that I'm talking about, that I've been trying to explain to people for a while, you'll have 100% at all times of whatever that thing is capable of producing. If it says that you got 100 watts or 200 watts, you're going to have a continuous flow of 200 watts of power. Your bank will be large enough that you can never fill this bank up as long as you're using energy off of this system. You'll have real-time, on-demand power and never have to worry about anything getting hot, because there's no backup of this energy. It's not meeting the resistance like it does the way that we're doing it now. When you're pushing that much power to it, something's got to give, and when something gives, something reaches its thermal breakdown and things fail. Your inverter gets hot, burns out, whatever. And even your electric motors, by running continuously trying to keep up with the wasted heat energy, if you got wasted heat energy, then you're pushing too much power to it. It's as simple as that. Anyway, I want to bring you over to this one over here. Robert Murray Smith, he's working on graphene technology. He's got a video out about how to build supercapacitors. And he does have a lot of high-tech terminology in there and different chemistry. But if you're interested in how capacitors are actually built, he shows you how simple it is. So I'm going to play this part right here. Make a supercapacitor, step by step.
Hi, so I've been asked lots of times to do a basic step by step, build a supercapacitor. And I thought, well, it's probably time to do it. Now, the video is going to be divided into three parts. There'll be a little bit of discussion about the components of a supercapacitor. Then we'll build two supercapacitors, actually, one a graphene supercapacitor and the other an ordinary activated carbon supercapacitor. Then we'll do a little bit of testing on it. Simple testing, really. All we're going to do is charge it and then discharge it through a little motor so you can see what the amp draw is. We're also going to use this thing. It's a Semaphore LC102 capacitor analyzer. Now, that's quite an expensive bit of kit, actually. That's about £1,000. So it's not something you're just going to rush out and buy unless you're really, really involved in supercapacitors. But we have one, because of course we are, and we'll use that to analyze the two little supercapacitors that we're going to make. Now, supercapacitors are actually astonishingly simple things. And here's one from GreenCap, which is a 500 farad, 2.7 volt supercapacitor. And if we take that apart, what we get is a roll like this. And if you unroll that roll, then you can see that it's a really simple construction. You've got two leaves, and those are separated by a separator. This is Celgard, probably something like that. It's a polypropylene separator. So you've got two leaves separated by a separator, and this is a metallic collector covered by some kind of activated carbon. Chances are this is made from coconut fibres, actually, is what they tend to make this stuff from, so it's quite good.
I'll pause this just for a second. What he's showing is a couple rolled out deals that are basically anything from activated carbon. A simple capacitor would be like you take two sheets of aluminum foil and you put some sort of dielectric in between there that basically is, a non-conductive material that keeps the plates separated. And so with that said, you can charge one side up higher than the other whenever you charge this deal. And so depending on what type of dielectric you use in the center of it, then that will determine, you know, its capacitance. But the electrolytic capacitors, that's where you get into a little bit different. And some of these supercapacitors are kind of like that because they actually have a little bit of electrolyte. It's like salt water between this these two materials that makes it, you know, more conductive in the center. So it sounds complicated, but it's really not. It's really ridiculously simple. Let's let him keep going there.
You lay that on thin, roll it up, stick it in a can, fill it full of electrolyte. So a supercapacitor has basically six components. There are five layers and an electrolyte. Now your first layer is your current collector. And your current collector can be absolutely anything that will collect current. So you're looking for something that will have a low resistance, so some kind of metal foil. Now the electrolyte in there actually does play quite an important role. So sometimes if you use one metal foil and you use, say, an alkali electrolyte, so say you're trying to use aluminium with potassium hydroxide, then aluminium wouldn't be appropriate. You'd need something that would live up to a potassium hydroxide environment, something like nickel. So when you choose your current collector, you have to pay attention to the system that you've got in place in total. But essentially, a whole load of these things will do. So we use some kind of metal current collector. Now I've got a whole range of metal foils, and here's good old aluminium. And that's quite a good one with something like sodium sulphate as a neutral electrolyte, because it won't react, and it'll still act quite nicely as a current collector. So you could use something like aluminium foil. This is obviously just kitchen foil you buy it in the supermarket. If you plan on using something like nickel hydroxide, potassium hydroxide, you're going to see something like this. This is a nickel foil. Now, I just bought that on eBay, and it was a few pounds for a couple of sheets of nickel foil. These are quite easy foils to get hold of, so you use nickel foil. Now, obviously, the whole point of this is to encourage you to experiment. So although we're going to do a step-by-step construction, it's really meant as a basis for you to be experimenting yourself. So there's a whole host of other foils you can use. I made a lead foil just by beating some lead that I got from the builder's merchant into a thin foil. It's quite an interesting one, probably worth a look at. It stands up really well, incidentally, in sulfuric acid. So if you're using an acidic, something like sulfuric acid or phosphoric acid, then that would probably make a good current collector. We've got copper, which is dead easy to buy. That's slug tape, actually, so you can buy that in the do-it-yourself store. And here's my favourite one, which is a bit of graph oil. Now, I tend to use graph oil quite a lot, because graph oil is really resistant to lots and lots of harsh chemical environments. It doesn't do anything. It does bring up the issue that maybe there's some intercalation going into the graph oil, and well, maybe there is. But to be honest, as long as your supercapacitor cycles 10,000 times and gives out power, at the point of use, who really cares? If you use a metal foil, it could equally be the argument there's a Faraday reaction. Yeah, sure, but it's really got to behave like a capacitor, cycle a hell of a lot of times, and give you point of the power of use. Then it's a good supercapacitor. Who really cares? If you want to investigate what's going on in there, sure you care. But in terms of use, it doesn't really matter. There's a whole host of things that you can use. You use zinc, magnesium. I got some printer's plates, actually. This is a magnesium printer's plate. It makes a really interesting current collector. These sheets of magnesium, sheets of zinc. You use zinc a lot in roofing. Again, here's a sheet of zinc, and I just bought that on eBay, and I've tried that in different situations. This is a little bit of steel that I've also tried. So there's a whole load of things that you can use. So the first thing is your current collector. Now your next thing that you need is some kind of active material. Now, what's used generally is a carbon. I use carbons because carbons have a huge surface area, and what's important in a supercapacitor is, on the whole, an EDLC layer formation using a huge surface area. So we use a nice carbon, and there are a whole load of carbons you can use. And this is the one that we're going to use in today's demonstration. It's activated carbon. It's actually fish tank carbon. It's used for cleaning the filters in fish tanks. And we're going to use that. You can use graphene, and I've done a whole load of ways of making graphene, obviously. So you could use graphene there, you could use activated carbon in there. This particular stuff, incidentally, is a carbon felt bought from a hobby shop. You you can use that as well. Any of these large surface area carbons will just do nicely. So you put your carbon layer in. Now, if we put the two layers at the same, then we get a symmetric capacitor, and that's what I'm going to show you. But the next thing that we put in, obviously, is some kind of separator. We need to keep the plus and negative apart. So we put a separator in there. Again, there's a whole load of materials that are good as separators. I've used tissue paper.
All right, so essentially when he's talking about the separator, that's the dielectric that I keep talking about. It's a material that it takes a certain amount of voltage to actually break down. So the higher the voltage, the higher the dielectric, so that, you know, like glass would be the best dielectric in between your plates. So it would take a lot of voltage in order to be able to break through that glass to short those plates out. And that's what usually goes wrong with a capacitor, is the dielectric breaks down in the center, and so you basically have a capacitor with a dead short where that energy can discharge because of how close those plates are together. So if you're into building any type of capacitor and you understand that, then you know that certain dielectrics have a breakdown point, you know, of a certain voltage, and once you know that, you know how much your capacitor, how much voltage your capacitor could store before it actually fails. Anyway, let's keep going.
This is Japanese tissue paper. I've used kitchen towel. Here's a nice bit of kitchen towel. I've used toilet roll. I've used glass fiber. I've used SoundGuard. I've used Dreamweaver. There's a whole load of these things you can use, and most of them are really easy to get hold of. And they wrap shirts in this. This obviously you can just buy anywhere, same as toilet paper, buy anywhere. So you put your separator in. Now you have another choice. Normally, for a symmetric capacitor, you put another layer of your carbon material. This is partly what makes it symmetric. But you don't have to. You can build an asymmetric capacitor, in which case you wouldn't use a carbon material. You'd use something like manganese dioxide, titanium dioxide, vanadium pentoxide, or other transmission metal oxides will make a very nice asymmetric capacitor. And then you pop your other current collector on. So that's the basics there of your capacitor. It's built right there. That's all there actually is to it. The rest of it are decisions that you make as you go along. And this is all about experimentation, and which is why I encourage you to experiment. There are so many combinations that you can more or less guarantee the ones that we're using at the moment aren't the best, and you may well discover a great combination of your own. Once you've built the supercapacitor like that, then you add the electrolyte. Now, the electrolyte, again, can be a whole host of things. You can use neutral electrolytes like sodium sulfate, acidic electrolytes like phosphoric acid or sulfuric acid, alkali electrolytes like the lithium hydroxide, potassium hydroxide, sodium hydroxide. There's a whole load of things you can use as electrolytes in there to get your supercapacitor to work. Ordinary table salt in water will do it. So you can put these units together, and that will make your supercapacitor. Now let's build one. So in order to make...
Let's pause this for a second. So, essentially what he's explained to you. I've explained capacitors, how you got two separate plates with a dielectric in the middle of it. So what basically a supercapacitor is that it has taken two different technologies and combined them together, so you have the equivalents of a battery and a capacitor mixed each other. So they're side-by-side plates, you know, with separators in between there, but they also have batteries built into them where the electrolyte, which would in this, you know, case it'd be salt water or any of the acids. And the reason why he was telling you about the different types of materials is because certain acids don't work good. Like sulfuric acid will work good with lead, but it doesn't want to work so well with aluminum because it'll degrade it faster or whatever. So if you get into that and you want to do the chemistry portion of it, you have to know what type of materials can withstand, you know, these different types of acids. But something simple like salt water, you know, it's going to be more compatible with a lot of different materials, you know, like aluminum. It doesn't rust, and you know, obviously you wouldn't want to do it with steel because it would cause the steel to rust or whatever. You know, different stainless steels might be better, or, you know, lead, that kind of stuff there. So a real simple battery is, you know, you got two plates of lead and you got salt water in the middle. That's a real simple battery. Or any acid, citric acid from oranges, grape juice or grapefruit juice or whatever, and so on down the line. But that acid, it is a chemical reaction, and so the way these are set up is that you have the capacitor on there for the storage, and you have the battery on there, so you can actually charge these things up, and they will act more like a battery, but they'll have the charge and discharge rate because of the way that this, basically, a supercapacitor is doing what I was saying about putting a buffer between your battery and the load and the battery and the charging system, because those outer plates will be carrying that load where the inner plate is there just to maintain the amount of power, so you'll smooth it out. That's why these things are so incredible, and by the different types of material as well, you can get more surface area off of a smaller surface, which sounds crazy, but it's true, because a perfectly smooth surface, you can only fit so many electrons on there. But if you got a rough surface, with a lot of points on there, little tiny points that you could only see under a microscope, it has actually more surface area. And so by getting all these different types of materials like graphene, they're able to actually produce more surface area to hold more of a charge. It's that ridiculously simple. And I could even see a case to where you could take copper tubing or even aluminum tubing for that matter, because you not only have the outer surface layer, but you have the inner surface of the tube. So if you had really tiny tubes of copper or aluminum, and you cut those down and you made plates out of these things to where you had an extreme amount of surface area, then you would have basically a supercapacitor. And combining that with the battery technology, which is actually built into the same exact thing, so you actually have a chemical reaction going on that's keeping those plates energized at all times until you use that energy up. So this, mixed with that, is why they keep saying that the future technology of batteries is getting better as well. So not only are capacitors getting better as well, because they're kind of merging batteries technology with capacitor technology and being able to store more energy because of the surface area of the way that they're actually doing this. And so even in battery technology, using graphene, like a graphene paste where your electrolyte is absorbed in there, you can actually get more surface area in that battery than you would from, say, your normal lead acid battery, where you only have so much in there. Actually, if you go and look inside of a lead acid battery, they're not solid plates down there. They have some oxides in there that actually gives it more of a surface area than it would have otherwise had with just a solid plate along there. But there's ways that we could actually use, in newer technology, 3D print some plates that have intentional, peaks on there, all the way down, so it's rough to the touch, and that gives you more surface area than just that smoothed out plate in itself. So, just waiting for science to catch up, folks. Let's keep going here.
Ourselves a supercapacitor. What we need is some kind of current collector, and I'm going to fall back on my good old trusty Graphon, and three mysterious jars. Now, you don't need to worry about these jars, I'm going to tell you what's in them. What's in this one is graphene oxide. Now, obviously, I make this myself, and I've done a load of different ways of making graphene oxide. So you need to make yourself a graphene oxide suspension. That's about 4 milligrams per milliliter. This particular one was made using the Tour method, and I've got a video on how to do that, and also how to wash it and process it and get into this stage, the separate video. So you make yourself some graphene oxide. The other thing is this stuff. This is just activated carbon. All I did with that was take some activated carbon, pop it in a blender until it was like a fine dust, and then I added a carrier. Now, I do a lot of work with inks, as you know. The carrier I chose here is actually acetone. And I chose acetone because the binder in there is a dissolves in acetone, and you can use a whole load of binders. If you don't like the idea of working with acetone, use water and PVA. That's just fine. The ratio is around about 10 to 5% of binder to weight of active material. Again, you'll have to experiment with that, depending on the binder that you choose, till you get a good ratio. That is a ratio that holds the thing together without it crumbling too much, but doesn't interfere with the conductivity of the particles that you're putting in there. So PVA will do it fine, polyvinyl alcohol will do it fine if you can get hold of it, PVDF, PTFE, a whole host of things actually. Carboxymethyl cellulose will do it. CMC is actually wallpaper paste. So there's a whole load of materials you can use. I use acetone because it dries very quickly. If you use water, then you have to give it a little bit of time to dry. Obviously, the graphene oxide is actually in water. Now, first thing you do to make the graphene oxide one, I'm going to cut a little bit off here first, actually, because we'll make the carbon one out of those two little strips. First thing you do to make the graphene oxide one is get your graph oil and then put some graphene oxide on it. There's a load of ways of doing this. This is not particularly careful. All I do is squeeze a load on and wipe it around until I get a coating of graphene oxide. If I want to make that a bit more controlled, I'd do a Dr. Blade method, or maybe I could spin coat it, or I could dip coat it. There's a whole load of ways of doing that. And once I've got a coating of graphene oxide on it, I put it onto a hot plate at 50 degrees C to dry it out. And when it's dried out, that's what you get. It's a bit of graphene oxide coated graph oil. We'll use that in a second to make a supercapacitor. But these other two bits that I got, I'm only going to make the supercapacitors about a centimetre square, something like that. They're very small. Cut them to the size that you want. Then take your activated carbon in your binder. And it's actually really quite liquid, this. So all I'm going to do is dip coat it. So just dip coat it on, and there you go, that's plenty. And leave that to dry. Because it's acetone, it'll dry really, really quickly. Dip coat the other one. Now we're making symmetric capacitors here. So if I wanted to make an asymmetric capacitor, instead of dip coating both of them in the same solution, what I'd do is I'd make up a manganese dioxide in acetone with binder, dip coat one in the activated carbon, one in the manganese dioxide, I would have an asymmetric capacitor. Here I'm making symmetric capacitors, so we dip both of them in the same material. Now I want a bit of my graphite oxide. I just cut myself a couple of strips of it. There we go. And all I want is a small bit of it. Because that's quite a lot, actually. So I just clean off a whole load of it. Don't be too harsh with it, obviously, because I've just broken it. There's my graphene oxide electrodes, my supercapacitor. In the meantime, they're nice and dry now. And there are my activated carbon electrodes. So there are my supercapacitor electrodes made. Let's have a close-up of that. Okay, so they're the made. We're going to make a supercapacitor. I'm going to use kitchen towel. Not for any reason, but because you're probably going to find kitchen towel really easy to get hold of. Just cut yourself a little bit of kitchen towel to cover those two electrodes. That'll do. And that'll do. All I now have to do is put electrolyte in there and connect them up. Now, they're asymmetric, so it doesn't matter which way around they go. After, it will matter which way around they go. But for the first time, it really doesn't matter. So we just connect those up. And and put a spot of electrolyte on. Now, the electrolyte, like I say, can be anything you want. It can be anything you choose it to be. You can use, as I say, a neutral one, like sodium sulfate. You can use an acidic one, or you can use an alkali one. This actually happens to be a neutral electrolyte. So a little bit of neutral electrolyte. That's it. That's my activated carbon supercapacitor. We do exactly the same with the graphene oxide. Okay, let's do a simple test. Let's put some charge on it. Now, because it's a water one, we can't really go above 1.2 volts. If you use different electrolytes, you can use different voltage and so improve the energy density. There are other things we could do, incidentally. If we compressed the activated carbon against the graphene, we'd get better contact, lower ESR, and a better supercapacitor. You can do those kind of things if you want, but to be honest, it isn't strictly necessary for this. So let's put that on charge. Now, I'm charging at 1.2 volts. Oops, I'm discharging it. We'll put it on charge. We're charging it at 1.2 volts, and you can see that it drops down really quite quickly. All we've got here is a little separate reading through the voltmeter, the ammeter, the power supply, and a little motor to run it. So that's all there is, actually. And we give that a few seconds to charge. And then we can discharge it through the motor and see we've got some real power in there. And there we go, there's that motor spinning. And it's outputting around 40 milliamps, somewhere around about there. It won't run for very long, because it's obviously 1 centimetre square at one layer. So it won't run for a terribly huge amount of time. But to be able to run that motor at all is pretty damned impressive. Now, I'm not fully charging it, because remember, capacitors charge quickly at the beginning, and as they go, they slow down on their charge. So to get that last little bit of charge takes an awful long time. To get that first bit of charge, it's actually very quick. So we've given a little bit of time to charge, and some discharge. Actually, 45 milliamps it puts out. So it's quite a lot of power on that little device. Now let's do the graphene one. So there's the graphene one made up with this electrolyte, and let's give it a bit of charge. And we can discharge it. There we go. Now, it may not look like the graphene one is better than the activated carbon one, but actually in these terms, it's pretty good. Is that graphene, remember, is very, very, very thin. The carbon's actually quite thick. In these terms, it's quite thick. So we seem to get a lot more power out of the carbon one than we do out of the graphene one, because the graphene one is just so much thinner. There's hardly any material on that at all. So we've got a 1 centimetre graphene. Now, fascinating though that is, let's have a look at the Sencor. Okay, so I've connected it directly to the Sencor. Lovely device. All you have to do is press the button mark capacitor value, and this will measure capacitance up to 20 farads. So I just press that and hold it. It takes a little bit of time for it to do that. And that's measuring 0.144 farads. Now we've connected up the carbon one, and now we'll find out what the capacitance value of that is. Take a little bit of time. The bigger the capacitance, the longer this thing takes. Okay, and that's measuring 3.95 farads. So there's... on this, and 0.14 farads on this. Mostly it's to do with the difference in thickness, the amount of material. So we've got here, in 1 square centimetre, a 4 farad capacitor in a single layer. Okay, it's at 1.2 volts. But we slap that together, we have actual 4 farads, we'll actually deliver power to a device in 1 square centimetre made on a benchtop in about 5 minutes flat. So I can only encourage you to experiment, because you can do amazing things if you experiment. A lot of this stuff is guidance. If you want to build one, then sure, follow the recipe. It's all there on the channel. Follow it. If you want to experiment, do some of the things that I've been suggesting to you, and you can get some crazy capacitance out there. So 4 farads, 1 square centimetre, 1.2 volts. That beats everything, pants down. I mean, I don't know what weight of material is on there. I would guess about 2/1000ths of a gram, something like that. So you're probably looking at a capacitance there in terms of material, about 500, 700 farads per gram. So take that, Rice, MIT, Caltech, Manchester. We can produce a material with a huge capacitance on a benchtop and turn it into a device that will run a motor. And we haven't even done any serious processing on it. We should really press that so that we can reduce the resistance between the backing and the material. But we want to work on inks and painting on, and we can do that and get astounding results. Anyway, I hope that was of interest to you, and thank you very much for watching.
The kind of research that Robert Murray Smith does is brilliant. I mean, he's got conductive ink and stuff that he works with, graphene technology, and, you know, if you go over there and subscribe to his channel and go back and look at some of his older videos and stuff like that, it's pretty impressive, the stuff that he's working on. But either way, all of this right here, the system said we needed better storage. He's been showing for years better ways to build batteries and better ways to build capacitor technology. And, you know, so it's time for science to actually catch up. This next little video is just one where a guy is taking one of these capacitors apart, but there was something in there that I wanted you to hear.
I'm sure if you're watching my video, you've known the difference, or at least heard of capacitors, and now supercapacitors. So for science today, we're going to tear one of each apart. One is going to be a 16-volt, 2200 farad regular electrolytic capacitor. Another one is one of the 2.7-volt, 500 farad green caps. Let me move the camera on over, and we'll start unwinding and see what we find. On the left, I got the regular electrolytic capacitor. That's what's left of the case, the top of it, and the actual coil of material inside of it. On the right, I got the super cap opened up, and this has also got a big coil. So let's start with the regular capacitor, just so everyone knows what it looks like. There's your two electrodes, and it keeps on going. Now inside this, looks like, just like any other one, you got two metals separated by an insulator. Some sort of papery, wax paper or something. Yeah. And that is the standard regular electrolytic capacitor. Chances are I probably got a little bit of moisture on my hands from the stuff, so I better clean my hands real quick. Now for the super cap, see if I can get this one nicely unwound here with my razor blade. Looks like this is the beginning right here. There we go. It's got like a paper to it. And you can see, it's got like three different taps in here, and they're really thick, so they're definitely able to handle the current. And right now, this is just paper. Oh, here comes the beginning of it. Ooh, it's got like this dry carbon. Looks like a dry carbon. It's got this... Yeah, this is like a... Feels like a paper. But it's got this black dry carbon on it, so definitely different. And it's dry. It's definitely not wet like an electrolytic. Here's one of the tie-in spots. And that is really thick. And let's see if I get some of this black. Believe it or not, this is actually getting a little cool to the touch. Definitely got to clean my hands after this because I'm not sure what's on it. But I'm not sure if this is lithium. No, definitely not. It ripped too easily like paper. It's like a black paper of some sort.
It's basically what Robert Murray said.
I think it's a form of carbon that's been printed onto it, but I'm not sure.
Graphene technology.
It definitely rips easily, and it's definitely cool to the touch. So I'm not sure what type of metal it is, but this is definitely different. Never seen this inside of an electrolytic capacitor. Yeah, it's definitely getting cool. So it's reacting, it, almost like it's an endothermic, because it's touching air now. So I'm not sure. But it coils for quite some time. So the basic setup is like an electrolytic capacitor, but instead of using two metals separated by a membrane, this one's got paper for membrane, but it's got this black stuff that's cool to the touch. And who knows, maybe I'll get cancer from this. So there you have it. You have the regular electrolytic capacitor, which I'm sure there's other videos on YouTube that show it's just two pieces of metal with a separator in it and little connectors, versus a supercapacitor, which has this black paper, which I guess is carbon coated, that doesn't come off on your hands, and it's kind of endothermic. It's a little cool to the touch, not like frozen or anything like that, but it's definitely cool to the touch. And if we remember looking at the bars on it, it has an awful lot of contact surface, so that's how you get your high amperage from a supercapacitor. If you have any questions or comments, go ahead and leave them below. Thanks.
Alright, so he basically tore apart a capacitor, and inside there you saw just exactly what Robert Murray Smith was doing on his table. It's waiting for science to catch up. These folks already know a lot of stuff, but they're not necessarily making it public, and that's why I like these videos where people are kind of like reverse engineering, term apart, looking inside to see what they're made of and that kind of stuff. And, you know, it's what you're seeing there when you're seeing a supercapacitor is basically a combination between a capacitor and a battery. And so that's why they're able to be compatible with, like what I was talking about, if you put a buffer between your battery and your load and your battery and your charging system, the capacitor portion of it can charge and discharge rapidly, whereas it takes longer to charge the battery itself up. So at that point in time, your battery is nothing more than maintaining. It's a supplementary system to the capacitor system. So modern day and future technology is going to be basically those two combined with some exotic materials that are able to hold a lot more surface area and a lot smaller space to be able to store more energy. In which case, then all these big old heavy batteries would go by the wayside, and you would have batteries that would have the capability of charging up rapidly. It's not that we don't have enough power to charge them rapidly, it's that the batteries aren't capable of charging that fast. And you heard about, even with the supercapacitor, because it's got partially a battery, that when you get to a certain point, it takes a little longer to charge it up, but it's that first initial charge, and once that thing is already charged up, it doesn't take anything to maintain it whatsoever. And so, a regular capacitor can charge and discharge rapidly multiple times over and over and over and over again without ever getting hot or failing. And so if you understand that, and you understand how I'm talking about shifting energy, how moving energy from one place to the next, you can do it rapidly without the resistance. Therefore, you're not going to have that thermal breakdown part that I talked about. I'm going to try to go back to this one right here. We've got a little bit of time left, and there was some more good stuff inside there. I'll have to get back to where I was, if I can find it. And
Faraday, the son of a blacksmith,
had finished his formal education when he was just 12 years old. He would never get to university, but he wasn't finished with learning, as he was fascinated by science. Faraday worked long and hard during the day, binding books. But in the evenings, he would read whatever scientific literature he could lay his hands on. He loved learning new things about the world, and he had this constant desire, this passion, to understand why things were the way they were. Reading scientific papers was one thing, but to really satisfy his craving for knowledge, Faraday was desperate to see the experiments themselves. And he eventually got his chance when he was given a ticket to attend one of the last lectures of England's greatest chemist of the time, Sir Humphry Davy. It was to change young Faraday's life forever. After watching Davy, awe-inspired and full of ideas, Faraday knew what he wanted to do with his life. He was determined to dedicate himself to furthering science. And that's just what he did. Within a year, Davy had appointed him as an assistant at the Royal Institution. With Davy as his patron and, well, his boss, Faraday studied all manner of chemistry. But what would inspire his greatest breakthroughs were the invisible forces of electricity and magnetism. In 1820, both were being studied by a Danish scientist, Hans Christian Ørsted, who'd made an extraordinary discovery. He passed an electric current through a copper rod and brought it close to a magnetic compass needle and saw that it made the needle rotate. To Ørsted, it was remarkable. He'd shown, for the first time, that an electric current can create a magnetic force. He'd bound electricity and magnetism together. Today, we call it electromagnetism, and it's one of the fundamental forces of nature.
Ørsted's discovery sparks off a whole new spate of inventive activity around and about the fields of electricity. You can almost see electrical experimenters vying, competing with each other to find new links between electricity and the other powers of nature.
At the Royal Institution, Faraday set about recreating Ørsted's work, which would mark his first steps to fame and fortune. And through his rigorous research, he concluded that there must be a flow of forces acting between the wire and the compass needle. The device he designed to demonstrate it would change the course of history. Faraday created a circuit using a battery like this, a pair of wires, and a mercury bath. Now, the circuit carries on through these copper posts, and this wire hangs freely. It dangles into the mercury. Now, because mercury is such a good conductor, it completes the circuit. When the current runs through the circuit, it generates a circular magnetic force field around the wire. Now, this interacts with the magnetism from a permanent magnet that Faraday had placed in the middle of the mercury. Together, they forced the wire to move. Faraday had proved that this invisible force really does exist, and he could see its effect, circular motion. This beautiful device was the first to convert electric current into continuous motion. Basically, it's the earliest ever electric motor. But Faraday was about to take this experiment further.
One of the lasting effects of Faraday's discovery of electromagnetic rotations in 1821 was that it showed that there was a relationship of some sort between electricity, magnetism, and motion.
Faraday explored this relationship in detail, and set himself an even more difficult challenge: to use magnetism and motion to make electricity. Eventually, his obsession, hard work, and determination paid off. The breakthrough came on the 17th of October, 1831, when Faraday took a magnet like this and moved it in and out of a coil of wire. He was able to detect a tiny electric current in the coil, moving one way and then the other. Faraday knew he was onto something. A few days later, instead of moving the magnet through the conducting wire coil, he set up the equivalent experiment by moving a conducting copper plate through the magnetic field. He didn't know it at the time, but as his spinning disc cut through this magnetic field, billions of negatively charged electrons were deflected from their original circular course and began to drift towards the edge. A negative charge built up at the outer edge of the disc, leaving a positive charge at the center. And once the disc was connected to wires, the electrons flowed in a steady stream. Faraday had generated a continuous flow of electric current. Unlike a battery, his current flowed for as long as his copper disc was spun. He'd created electrical power directly from mechanical power.
Although Faraday's discovery of induction was extraordinarily important in its own right and had profound effects for the understanding of electricity and technology for the rest of the 19th century, for Faraday, what it did was to open up a decade of powerful research, because it gave him the clue about how he should pursue his research.
While Faraday continued his work, trying to understand the very nature of electricity, inventors from across Europe were less interested in the science and more interested in how electricity could make them money.
What's actually quite remarkable, you know, certainly from a contemporary perspective, is that by and large, nobody really seems to care very much what electricity is. You don't have great theoretical debates as to whether it's a force or a fluid or a principle or a power. What they're really interested in is what electricity can do.
Faraday, living in a world of steam power, was informing the scientific community about the nature of electricity. But at the same time, another breakthrough in how we could actually use it had been made. This would be the first device that really brought electricity out of the laboratory and into the hands of ordinary people. The telegraph. The key to understanding the telegraph is understanding a special kind of magnet, an electromagnet. Basically, a magnet created by an electric current. The first electromagnets were developed independently by William Sturgeon in Britain and Joseph Henry in America. And just as Faraday had discovered that by coiling his wire, he could increase the current in it produced by the moving magnet, so Henry and Sturgeon discovered that by adding more coils in their current-carrying wires, they could make a more concentrated magnetic field. Basically, the more coils, the more turns, the stronger the magnet. So if I pass a current through this electromagnet, you can actually see the effects of the magnetic field. This is the standard school experiment of sprinkling iron filings on top of the magnet. If I give it a tap, see the iron filings follow the contours of the field. This allows us to visualize the effects of magnetism. To make an electromagnet even stronger, Henry and Sturgeon discovered that they could place certain kinds of metal inside the electromagnetic coil. The reason iron is so effective is fascinating, because you can think of it as being made up of lots of tiny magnets, all pointing in random directions. At the moment, this is not a magnet. The tiny magnets inside are aligned similarly to these compass needles. If you see, they're all pointing in different directions. But when you apply a magnetic field, they all align together. They all combine, these magnets, and cumulatively they add to the strength of the electromagnet. So what Henry and Sturgeon did was place two electromagnetic coils on each arm of their horseshoe to create something that was many, many times more powerful. And we can see the power of this horseshoe electromagnet. If I turn it on and use something slightly bigger than iron filings, these small pieces of iron, look at the strength of the magnetic field holding them in place. What's important to remember, of course, is that this electromagnet only works all the time there's a current passing through it. As soon as I turn off the current, the magnetism disappears. Early experimenters showed off this power by lifting metal weights. Henry even made one big enough to lift a ton and a half of metal. Impressive, but not world-changing. But place that magnet much further away, at the end of a wire, and suddenly you can make something happen at your command, in an instant. This ability to control a magnet at a distance is one of the most useful things we've ever discovered.
If electricity can be made visible a long way away from the original source of power, then you've got a source of instantaneous communication.
By the middle of the 1840s, Samuel Morse had developed a messaging system based on how long an electrical circuit was switched on or off. A long pulse of current for a dash, a short burst for a dot. This allowed messages to be sent and received by using a simple code.
Contemporary early Victorian commentators reflect on the fact that electricity and the telegraph is literally making their world a smaller place. You very often get a sort of rhetoric throughout the 19th century when people are talking about the telegraph, about how more communication, more understanding will render war obsolete, because we'll all understand each other better. I mean, retrospectively, it seems hopelessly utopian.
By the 1850s, Europe and America were crisscrossed with land-based telegraph wires. But the dream of instant global communication was frustratingly out of reach. This was because there was still no cable capable of carrying messages between two of the greatest powers on Earth, Britain and America. Many experts were convinced that a working Atlantic cable was impossible. But those who disagreed knew that if they could solve this problem, it could make them serious money. And in the 1850s, American businessmen and British engineers joined forces to prove this could be done. Attempt after attempt ended in disaster. The heavy cables kept snapping in heavy seas and storms. Finally, on the 29th of July, 1858, two parts of a cable were spliced together in mid-Atlantic. You see, a single cable was simply too big to have been carried by one ship. Then one end was taken to Newfoundland and the other end to Southwest Ireland. 6 days later, the first direct link between the two most powerful nations in the world was in place. The project was hailed a huge success, and a formal message of congratulations was sent from Queen Victoria to President Buchanan. But before the celebrations were over, things started to go very wrong. This is Chief Engineer Bright's original notebook. You can see here Queen Victoria's original message. Now, it's only 98 words long, but it took 16 hours to transmit. The telegraph operators on the other side found it very hard to decipher the message. The electrical signals that they were receiving were blurred and distorted, and they kept asking for words to be repeated over and over again. So you can see here, repeat after sending, waiting to receive, no signals. Clearly, transmitting across the Atlantic wasn't going to be as straightforward as people had hoped. Over the next few days, several hundred messages were exchanged, but those arriving in Newfoundland became almost impossible to decipher. Just a jumbled mess of dots and dashes. There was a serious problem with the cable, and it was getting worse. Well, the 1858 cable was never fully repaired, and the end finally came when British engineer Wildman Whitehouse mistakenly believed that by increasing the signal voltage, he could force the messages through to Newfoundland. The cable simply stopped working altogether. At the time, increasing the voltage by using more powerful batteries made sense. Most experts believed electric current flowed through a cable like a fluid in a pipe. Increasing the voltage was the equivalent of increasing the pressure in the system, forcing the current through to the other end. But the telegraph was actually carrying pulses or ripples of current along the cable, not a continuous stream. And over long distances, these pulses were becoming distorted, making it difficult to tell what was a short dot and which was a longer dash. By studying the effectiveness of underwater cabling, scientists were beginning to understand that electric current didn't always flow like water, but was also creating invisible electromagnetic waves or ripples. And it's this breakthrough that would lead to a new branch of research into the electromagnetic spectrum and solve the problems of the Atlantic telegraph. In effect, the transatlantic cable was a giant, ambitious, hugely expensive experiment. The failure of science to keep pace with technology had been exposed, and a new, more theoretical, and for me, much more exciting approach to understanding electricity began to unfold. Armed with this new understanding of how electric pulses actually moved along the cable, improvements were made to its composition, design, and how it was laid. It would take another 8 years of scientists and engineers working together before a working cable was finally put in place. And on Friday, the 27th of July, 1866, a message was sent from Ireland to Newfoundland, clear and crisp. A treaty of peace has been signed between Austria and Prussia. At last, the dream of instant transatlantic communication had become a reality.
The success of the 1866 cable makes the world a smaller place yet again. The change from a world in where it took days or weeks or months for information to travel, you know, to a world in which information took seconds or minutes to travel, you know, is far more profound, I think, than anything that's taken place during my lifetime.
The invention of the telegraph changed ordinary people's lives, but it would be the breakthroughs in how we used continuously flowing electric current that would have an even greater impact. Because inventors were developing a new way of using electricity. To make something every person in the world would want. Electric light. Until the 19th century, we only knew of one way to make our own light. Burn things. And by the middle of the 19th century, we'd perfected a very effective way of lighting our homes, using gas. A typical British home in the 1860s would have been lit like this. Highly flammable gas would have been pumped directly into people's houses through a network of pipes. But these gas lamps were too dull for large outdoor areas. So railway stations and streets began to be lit from a more powerful source, electric arc lights. The first arc lights were demonstrated by Michael Faraday's mentor, Sir Humphrey Davy, at the Royal Institution as early as 1808. And they worked by passing a continuous spark of electricity across two carbon rods. But their intense white glow was just too bright for people's homes. For an electric light to compete with gas, it would need to be subdivided into many smaller, less powerful, and more gentle lamps. Whoever succeeded in bringing electric light to every home in the land was guaranteed fame and fortune. And by the early 1880s, the most famous, most prodigious, most fiercely competitive inventor in the world had taken on the challenge. The American Thomas Alva Edison.
For Edison, invention was a passion. It's what he loved doing. He loved being in the laboratory. The first thing that drove that passion is that it was a lot of fun for Edison. I think that was the thing that he found most exciting, is that this was something he did well, and it allowed all of his creativity to come to the fore.
Edison is Mr. Electrical Invention. He's the man they trust. He's the man that they think can do anything. He's also the man who has his carefully cultivated connections with entrepreneurs, with people who are willing to put their cash where Edison's mouth is, so to speak, and back him in this sort of venture.
For Edison, the money was probably the least important reason. For Edison, the money was important for one reason, to allow him to do the next project.
Edison had assembled a group of young and talented engineers at a cutting-edge laboratory in New Jersey, 26 miles from Manhattan. Menlo Park would become the world's first research and development facility, allowing Edison's team to invent on an industrial scale.
They worked incredible hours. You know, one of them talked about how he hardly ever saw his children because he was in the lab all the time. But they knew they were in the midst of something really important, right? That if Edison succeeded, right, if they succeeded with Edison, that their futures were secure.
Edison's dream was to bring electric light to every home in the land. And with his team of engineers behind him and the vision of an electric future ahead, he launched his campaign. The race to bring electric light to the world was to play out in the great cities of the time, New York, Paris, London. Edison's Menlo Park team set about developing a totally different...
All right, so you know that part of the story. Edison, got the light bulb going. It wasn't actually the first lighting system, but it was the first one that was able to get into, the homes, and then along come Tesla with the AC current and such like that, which made things even better. But a lot of the things that I played today were to look back and see how different, different inventors got to a certain conclusion on different things. And so with that said, with new technology, and factoring in what they were doing back in the day, and then an understanding of how the mechanics of energy actually works, now we got basically the gate is wide open. So just like Edison, with the right team of researchers, you know, any of you could actually get some actual working prototypes built within a ridiculously small amount of time. Tesla talked about pulsing these currents in order to ramp up the voltage, and that voltage wouldn't meet the resistance that you would normally incur. And the modern day circuitry that we've got is mind blowing. It's simple. These RC motor controllers are capable of pulsing transformers. And so if you understand what a modern day transformer, how it's actually built, and you'll note that if you actually watch the construction of it, that it is actually part capacitor as well as a step down transformer. So when they send that power down the line to you, there's no way you could use that power at the high rate of frequency that it's at and the actual amount of voltage that they're sending down that line. But they're able to send it out really far because of the way that they understand how this energy actually travels. And then whenever it finally gets to the can that you call, you know, the pole pig or the transformer that's up on your power pole, that basically slows that energy down, smooths it up, drops the voltage down, and makes it usable for inside your house. And once it starts coming into your house, it's still coming in with too much power. And so if you don't understand that, then that's where they get you as far as the price of what they're actually charging you. Because a lot of the energy, most of the energy that comes to your house gets wasted in the form of heat. Not to mention whatever else could bleed off through, poorly designed electrical systems and so on down the line. But these appliances don't require nowhere near the amount of power that we're pushing to them. And when we get that sorted out, then we can take whatever excess power that your first appliance can't use, and we can ship it on down the line to the next appliance, and it will only use what it needs, and any that appliance there rejects, it'll send it on down the line as well to the next appliance. So we have the capability and the technology to make our house so incredibly energy efficient that our electric bills should drop straight to the dirt by utilizing this information. That's why as soon as I finish my lab, which I'm still working on, it's unfortunate, but, you know, it's a financial issue, but I'm sorting it out by myself. As soon as I get that done, I'm going to put all these stuff into practice. I've already got devices ready to show everybody and to show them this, everything that I've been talking about in real time, so that you can understand how simple it actually is. If you understand how air pressure, how water pressure, then you understand how voltage pressure works as well. And with a few tricks of what we've learned about surface area, the capacitor technology is getting much better. By combining capacitor technology and battery technology, you've got the storage solved. And by using the systems that I'm talking about and the way that I'm talking about them, whatever your solar panel is capable of doing, if it says that it's capable of 200 watts continuous, then you're going to get the full 100% of that 200 watts. And using that energy differently than you would have normally, instead of just trying to go right straight into an inverter type system to where you're going to actually have now losses in the system, you put a buffer between that panel that is much larger than the amount of energy necessary for that inverter to actually function properly, then two things is going to happen. You're going to have a surplus of energy, plus your inverter is not going to get hot because you're not trying to shove too much power to it. And when it comes down to the voltage regulator systems that they actually use, charge controllers and such, those charge controllers are another weakness in the system, because they are obviously there to act as a resistance and to basically shut the power off once your batteries get to a certain charge. But by doing it the way that I'm talking about, where you got this huge buffer tank between that, you got all this voltage pressure available to you, and it's only going to, you know, take the path of least resistance. And so if you got any you know, load attached to it already, it's going to allow that load to run without having any energy backing up in that load. It will leave it in that storage tank and use it as needed. So what I've showed in the videos that I've done, you know, I did one video called Unsubscribe. I did one called 9 Volt, and I've done videos previously since with a DDS signal generator. And I showed you that in them entire systems, there's absolutely no batteries involved in the system. That you're able to utilize energy that you couldn't otherwise use. It would have been classified as junk electricity. When people were constantly complaining, well, oh, there's not enough current, there's not enough watts, there's not enough amperage, and all this kind of craziness, I was trying to get the point across to them that at this stage in the game, you don't need the current watts and amps. What we're trying to do is move the energy rapidly, store it, and then, from that point on, then you can bring back in your regular measuring tools, and that energy that you're using now, you can measure what the draw is on with your appliances from that point on. We weren't trying to run anything off of what we were talking about. We were trying to show how you can take this energy without meeting the resistance and store it rapidly. Rapidly enough that you can keep the first tank completely full, or even only three quarters full, and the smaller tank right underneath it would constantly be topped off as long as there was more voltage pressure in the first one. So you didn't even have to fill the first one completely up. But that gave you an extra buffer for all any excess energy that would be rejected by the system to stay inside there. So it's not trying to overpressurize anything, and it's not trying to shove too much current to it. So that's what makes the concept so efficient. Well, anyway, folks, we're down there. I hope you enjoyed today's show. Kind of had a little bit of a rough start because of Google's shenanigans with the doggone browsers. So you got to go in and you got to set your permissions for your Flash player if you're having trouble on different browsers for your radio player. But once I get this other deal set up with a different company, then Google won't be able to do that anymore, because we'll actually have a phone app that you could use to listen in via your mobile devices and such. So anyway, you've been listening to the Mad Science Show. Stay tuned, and coming up next is the Music with Kara Hour. So peace and love, everybody. Take care.
That stood up to me.
Yeah, but we can forget about him.
Yeah, it was just one ant.
Ooh,
one ant.
Yeah, you're right. It's just one ant.
Yeah, boss, they're puny.
Puny? Say, let's pretend this brain is a puny little ant.
Did that hurt?
Nope.
Well, how about this one?
Are you kidding?
Well, how about this?
You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up.
Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life.
It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line. That's why we're going back.
Does anybody else want to stay?
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission. to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap!
Operator, give me the number for 911.
I got a laptop. I make music with my friends. I've got a laptop, baby. I make music with my friends. There it is.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch.